The recordings have started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Curative Rights Protection PDP Working Group call held on the 14th of July, 2016. On the call today, we have Osvaldo Nuova, Petter Reinforth, Phil Corwin, Holly Lance, Keith Drazik, John Passero, David Mayer, and George Kirokos. I have listed apologies from Lori Schulman. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, David Tate, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Petter.
Thank you, Petter Reinforth here. And I welcome you, and I especially welcome, one of our IGO representatives, Jonathan Passero. So we shall welcome to the meeting.
Yeah, David Sotola is on the line as well.
Okay, excellent. Welcome.
Thank
you. Glad you could join us today for, as you can see, we have added a special point on the agenda today where we'll hear further from you and that will also give us the long thought opportunity to get direct reply to some of our working group questions. However, we'll start with a brief review of the ICANN 56 discussion on the eternal legal expert opinion from Professor Swain. I don't know how many of you that were not on the on the Helsinki meeting that I had today, but we had an initial brief on Professor Swain's report and discussion on that in Helsinki, and I can't really remember if we had any specific topics, questions that we didn't have time to discuss in Helsinki, but I'll just start with some initial interesting comments from Professor Swain, where he said that even focusing on immunity, some generalization is required, and immunity obligations vary by state and by the IGO concerned. Immunity declarations are often based on organization-specific treaties to which not all states are party, and even states subject to the same international obligations implement them in varying ways. There is no clear yes or no when it comes to the immunity. That was my comment. And Professor Swain also said that while jurisdictions in which the IGOs are active may offer guidance, other jurisdictions offer much less, and there is no certain overlap between states with a developed IGO immunity jurisprudence and those hosting registrars or domain name registrants. And he also said that his memo will focus on jurisdiction on which follow-on litigation seems likely, and particularly the United States. He also said that one rather relevant question is whether, in light of an IGO's assent to mutual jurisdiction, its immunity remains. And here the more likely answer it is, and this is Professor Swain, is that it will not. IGOs are capable of waiving their immunity from suit, and if they do so, they may no longer interpose immunity as a defense if another party commences a judicial action falling within the scope of that waiver. The grant of mutual jurisdiction would likely establish such a waiver as it would for a state entity otherwise entitled to foreign sovereign immunity. And this waiver would be construed narrowly, but it would likely permit proceeding against an IGO at least some domestic courts. And then if we just turn quickly to his final comments, well, you said that one legal available option is to maintain the status quo, meaning for us that there's no changes or modifying or creating any new dispute resolution policies. As an one of the alternatives, he says also that the way that IGOs typically resolve the tension between immunity and judicial processes is to establish a non-judicial dispute resolution process, usually consisting of some form of arbitration. And I presume that that is also one of the possible solution, at least at the second step for us. I'll leave it there and see if there is anyone from our working group that wants to give us some more comments. Yes, Phil, I see your hands up.
Yes, thank you, Peter. Phil Corwin for the record. And I just wanted to point to two short provisions of the Swain memo, which I'd certainly like to have a dialogue with the our guests from the IGOs when they present orally their views. And the first is on page 26 of the memo, directly under the heading of maintaining the status quo, where he writes, even if one assumes that an IGO absent mutual jurisdiction might be capable of asserting immunity, affording them a means of surrendering that immunity via the mutual jurisdiction provision is not itself an infringement. Accordingly, as a purely legal matter, it seems unlikely that the mutual jurisdiction provision, as it may be accepted by an IGO, establishes or occasions a violation of IGO immunity. And as explored further below, it may seem more appropriate to require an IGO to abide by a judicial process, given that it elected to initiate UDRP proceedings, than it would be to require a domain name registrant to accept the IGO's preferred alternative. That passage, and just in combination with the final paragraph of the I'm looking for the other provision I wanted to cite. Oh, yeah. In the final paragraph, he describes in discussing a possible alternative, he says at the final, and this is the final paragraph of the memo, whether such an accommodation is appropriate in light of the immunity often owed IGOs is ultimately a policy question. Now, I take these passages not as dictating any final outcome for this working group, but standing for the proposition that there's no legal compulsion for us to create a separate CRP for IGOs with an arbitration type appeal rather than the mutual jurisdiction, court to a mutual jurisdiction appeal, that it's a policy question rather than a legally compelled outcome. And I'll stop there, but that's the main thing I drew from Professor Swain's very long and detailed memo, and one I'd like to hope that the IGO folks will get into when they present their views. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. And I also see at the chat room, George Kirkus referred to paragraph 59 explicitly compared one treaty for World Bank from a different treaty in a different Supreme Court of Canada case involving Northwest Atlantic Fisheries Organization. And I also saw that you referred to a Canadian case in your report. So we're going into that in a moment. As if Phil, your hands is up. You want to add something? Okay. Yeah, I'll see also for possible options, Mary Wong said, for possible options were identified by Professor Swain in his memo for the working group to consider as part of its deliberations. I'm not sure if will someone make their voice heard online, or shall we perhaps pass into point three of our agenda today? I think we can do so, because there are already some discussions and questions. Part four. Thanks again for our RGO guest to be here today, and thank you for your written input and comments on Professor Sain's report. As you may know, we have looked forward to updated comments from IGOs during our work, not just reminders of the initial statements that were made several years ago. So this is a very welcome initiative. But before we start with the topic as such, just let me refer to your initial statement that it is important to remind the ICANN community in general of the broader context of the IGO's request for protections of their names and acronyms at the top and second levels. And the first part of your comments relates more to the ongoing work with finding a way for permanent initial protection for IGO names and acronyms. And I can assure you that we fully agree with the importance to find an acceptable solution on this part. And even if the initial protection is not the topic of this working group, my co-chair, Phil Corvin, and I discussed this yesterday with ICANN staff, and we're planning to find a way to remind ICANN border within the decision on this topic. That is also because, depending on the solution of such initial protection, the preventative aspects, the outcome of our work in this working group regarding dispute resolution may end in a different way. So, enough for me. Please, Jonathan Passaro or David Satovla, who wants to start, comment on your comments, your memorandum.
Well, thanks for the, it's David Satovla here. thanks for the invitation to participate in your working group deliberations today. I don't think we have a lot more to say than what's in the memo. The memo was prepared by the three of us who were at the ICANN 56 meeting in Helsinki. So it's our views. Doesn't purport necessarily to be the views of the entire IGO coalition, which number about 60. And I think in terms of the memo, I mean, we made our comments in the working group meeting that you had in Helsinki, and then took you up on your offer to provide some written comments on the Swain memo itself, and we've done that. So we don't really have additional things to say, and I think if the working group is looking for an IGO position, meaning from the IGO coalition, we can go back to the other members and seek to do that. Otherwise, you have the reflections of the three of us who attended the Helsinki meeting here.
Thanks. Yes, well, I would say that we have sent out a couple of times also some specific questions, and of course, I mean, the topic we are dealing with in a working group that we have done for quite a long time now, it's related to you. So apart from the external legal experts' comments, it's of course very interesting to have your inputs. But at the same time, we are also in the phase where we will we have to come out with our initial comments and suggestions. So that's why It will be very interesting today, as well as we had the opportunity in Helsinki to hear if you have any specific further inputs. I just made one note before we proceed to the discussion list. I saw you you referred to the recent Veles versus World Bank case in the Canada Supreme Court, and what the Supreme Court made clear that was that the World Bank's privilege and immunity stand firm in preventing access by third parties to its archives and its staff. I also noting that any implied waiver of its immunities would have a chilling effect on collaboration with domestic law enforcement. And that's, of course, relates to immunity, but not on the name rights and not connected to domain names as we are dealing with here. And also, as we heard from Professor Swain, if we look at this in a global perspective, we don't have any clear answer, yes or no, to that immunity case. I know that Brian is not here, but I don't know if any of you other RGO representatives could say something about how many IGO-related dispute resolution cases that you think can be expected annually, and also have you tried to use or thought of using either the UDRP or the URS through the years? And if you haven't, and if you decided to not use it, what was the most important reason?
Thanks, Petter. David Sotola again. In fact, the World Bank did go through a UDRP process in the early 2000s. It's a case that's cited in Professor Swain's memo, and we prevailed in that case. I speak only for the bank in that regard and not the other IGOs. I have no idea whether they would seek to get such relief through that forum or not because of the immunity issue. To the first part of your question, when the guidebook came out for the new GTLD round in late 2011-2012, we took a look at the number of domains that others had registered using World Bank in one form or another. And at that, at that time, there were, I forget the exact number, but something like 300 domains. And we looked at them and determined that there were about 50 or 60 that we really cared about and were able to deal with most of them through cease and desist letters. But again, that was, you know, in the age when there were 20 or 23 GTLDs. There are a lot more now. I don't have current numbers on domain squatting that we would be interested in. The issue for us is one of the issues for us in that context is the cost. And I don't know what the cost was in 2002. I don't know the multiple of that cost if we had to resort to either through the UDRP or a UDRP-like process that had an arbitration provision associated with it. The arbitration, I assume, would still incur a cost for the IGOs, so that's still an issue for us. So it's not just the immunities, and I think that goes back to the point that your co-chair Phil made in Helsinki, and that we reiterated in our comments that the discussion is really in a broader context for us about, you know, the totality of the protection of our names and acronyms at the first and second levels, and that our comments in this regard were really just for the purpose of the exercise that the GNSO working group is going through.
Okay, thank you. And sorry, John Passara, I've seen your hands up for a while now. Please. The line is yours.
Maybe he's on mute.
Yeah. John, can you hear us? We can't hear you. No, sorry, we can't.
John, this is Terry. I see your microphone has been activated, and it's not muted on our side. If you could just please check your microphone on your side. Otherwise, I'll send you a private Adobe Connect chat, and you could provide me your telephone number if we need the operator to dial out to you.
Yes, in the meantime, I see, Phil, your hands up, also up, if you want to give a short comment.
Well, Peter, I wanted to have a little bit of a back and forth with Mr. Sotola and Mr. Passero, so it might be better if we wait till John is
on audio. Yeah, okay.
I just have a couple of clarifying questions about their memo.
And John is now on audio.
Great. Sorry about that. I guess my computer microphone isn't working.
No problem. You're welcome.
So John Passero from the OEC for the record. I first wanted to speak to this question of I don't know if I can only mute my audio for a second. Speak to this question of waiver of immunities. Because from the outset, we've never claimed that we cannot waive our immunities, but we've tried to explain to you why this is something that we, in general, don't do and why immunities are so important to the functioning of international organizations. And in that respect, I'd like to direct you to the memo that we sent to all of you on the 16th of January, 2015, where we actually specifically responded to this question of waiver of immunity. And we said submission to the UDRP and URS as currently drafted would necessitate waiving IGO of immunity from legal process, which would involve a specific decision taken at the highest levels of our governance structures. In fact, IGOs have only rarely and exceptionally waived their immunity for any purposes. Doing so for application to the UDRP would be unacceptable. And so, you know, again, this question has been sort of a moving target because from the outset when we started discussing these issues, the question was, you know, why can't IGOs use the UDRP currently? And we explained to you that we couldn't use it because of the mutual jurisdiction provision, which, again, entails a waiver of immunity. And that's, and again, we've gone through pains to try to explain why this thing in general we can't do. So, again, I'd like to just refer you to those responses that we gave to you a year and a half ago because it's useful to keep in mind for this instance. And then with respect to an estimated number of cases per year, as you know, that's something that we haven't really had to deal with at this point because there are the temporary protections in place. So it's a bit of a catch-22 question, I suppose, without, you know, because we have those current protections in place, fortunately, we haven't had to deal with domain name disputes as a general rule with maybe some few exceptions. I'm not aware of any related to the OECD. But again, this is something that could become a major problem and a significant issue for us in the event that our temporary protections were lifted. There's also a statement from George Kirkus about something involving an ambassador from Switzerland, the OECD. I just want to clarify that diplomatic immunity and immunity of international organizations are two separate questions. And on a more technical and specific point, specifically related to that case, the immunities of ambassadors to the OECD depend on the states which they represent. They don't come from the OECD. So the only persons whose immunities depend on the OECD itself as an organization would be the people who actually work for the OECD Secretariat. So our Secretary General, and then much lower down the totem pole, people like me have what's called functional immunities, which are just related to the tasks that we carry out specifically for our organization. So it's a very different question when you're talking about diplomatic immunity versus the immunity of international organizations. Thank you.
Thank you. And now, Phil.
Yeah, thank you, Peter, and Phil Corwin for the record. And I just had a couple of questions for John and David about the memo, just from the clarification of the group. In the first paragraph, it says the views expressed in the memo or those of the authors may not be shared by all IGO observers in the GAC. We understand that, and are subject to confirmation by respective management of the authors' organizations. I take that statement to mean that at this point, this memo is just the personal views of the three authors and has not yet been endorsed by any of the IGOs you are employed by. Is that correct, and are you seeking the endorsement of your organizations for this, or is it going to remain strictly a personal statement?
David Sotola here. Well, Phil, we wanted to be able to respond to your invitation to submit remarks in advance of this working group meeting, and really the only practical way to do that without running it up the management chains of even three organizations and then coordinating it was to put that small caveat in it.
Yeah, I understand that, and I appreciate the fact that you provided us with this memo and attended the session in Helsinki. I'm just wondering, in terms of the weight of this, whether this is just going to remain a personal statement or whether there's going to be any attempt to make it a more official statement on behalf of your organizations.
Again, David Sotola. I suppose the question of the weight would depend on, or the gravitas, would depend on both the clearance within our three respective organizations, but then also by the IGO community, and to get a consensus view on that. That, to me, doesn't change what are the underlying arguments, and we, made an attempt to make those arguments factual. These are the positions that are stated there about context or reflect what's in the overall ICANN record. And I don't think we really provided any opinion one way or another on Professor Swain's memo. So whether we run it up the organizations or not, I don't think would affect the underlying message. So, I mean, you can judge for yourself whether you think it's going to, be helpful for your analysis or not.
Oh, well, it is helpful, but when we consider it, there is some difference between considering it as personal views and considering it as official views of prominent IGOs. Let me move on to the next clarifying question. I just have four. This won't take a long time. There are parts in this memo where you agree with the portions of the Swain memo to support your views. But then on page 2, you say no inference should be drawn as to the applicability of the questions posed in the Swain memo or the adequacy, correctness, or completeness of the analysis in the memo or in general or is applied or to be applied to any particular set of circumstances. So having taken that into account, have any of you identified, are there any important questions you think he wasn't asked, and is there anywhere where you think his legal analysis is just incorrect? Because it's not clear from that, you know, kind of that statement how you feel about the overall memo.
So sorry if I may. This is John Passaro from the OECD. So Professor Swing is dealing with an extremely broad and complex set of questions in a fairly short amount of time. As we tried to put in the memo, I think we think that the only really pertinent question is the one regarding the specific context of IGOs protecting our name through UDRP disputes. And on that question, it came out pretty clear from him that the IGOs do have a right to immunities in those cases. So the caveats that we put in there, one of the main reasons we put that in there was because he's dealing with a very complex set of issues that touches on a lot of things that are of no relevance to this specific matter, and we didn't want to endorse the memo as a whole or anything like that because the analysis on specific issues that aren't necessarily directly relevant might not be exactly how we interpret things. So we just wanted to be clear that what the scope of our endorsement analysis was.
Yeah. Okay. Last two questions. You know, in your memo, you repeatedly refer to the immunities enjoyed by IGOs, and this working group recognizes those immunities, and that, of course, is why we sought an expert in this field to give us guidance and took the time to get that input rather than trying to guess what it was. Having said that, clearly you're asserting that any mutual jurisdiction clause violates the recognized scope of the immunities. I'm just trying to understand, are you asserting that in the context of trademark or trademark-like disputes that IGO immunity is absolute? He identified three forms of immunity: absolute, restrictive, and functional. And so are you asserting it's absolute in the case of trademark disputes or trademark-like disputes, or are you asserting that it's one of the other two choices, but that the legal analysis would compel creation of a new CRP because requiring submission to a court of mutual jurisdiction if there is an appeal would clearly violate the relevant immunity under any circumstances?
John Passaro from the OECD. I think we're mixing several questions here. As I said a few minutes earlier, as we said in the memo that we sent in January, as we've tried to make clear over and over again, it's not you can't violate our immunities just by asking us to do something. The question is, when what we've stated from the beginning is that submitting to the UDRP would require us waiving our immunities, which is something that we don't do for the reasons that we've expressed over and over again. I think we're also getting a little bit confused on the issue of absolute versus functional immunities here. Those aren't types of immunities. In the context of the Swain memo, he wasn't talking about different types of immunities. He was talking about the different approach that courts might take to analyzing
right.
the scope of IGO immunities. And there's no need to choose between any of those different avenues because, again, on even the more restrictive approach that Professor Swain discussed, he said that IGOs would enjoy immunities in this context because protecting our names and protecting our identities would, on most courts' reading, be something that is fundamental to the functioning of an IGO. And so this would clearly fall within the scope of immunities, even if they were analyzed on a restrictive approach.
Okay. Hey, final question. The memo refers, as well, to the ongoing consideration by the board of the conflicting views of a previous GNSO working group and the GAC recommendations on IGO protections. That was a topic that received some substantial attention at the council meeting in Helsinki, and some dismay, which you, I'm sure, you and the GAC share that process has gone on for 2 years now without resolution. And from the point of view of this working group, whatever that final board decision is going to be. It will be very helpful in the final stage of our work to know what the final decision was, because the preventative remedies adopted, to the extent they are, would feed into our analysis of what's required to add to that for when there is, despite those protections at the second level, an alleged infringement. Do you guys have any feeling for when the board's going to wrap that up?
David Sotolo here. Thanks, Phil, for raising that, and you also very kindly raised it during the joint GAC-GNSO meeting in Helsinki. And like you, we're very anxious to see, if not a resolution, at least a decision. But I haven't found the crystal ball that would allow me to make a prediction about when that's going to be, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, we had thought we had gotten a signal last summer of 2015, that we'd have something final by the fall, and now it's almost a year past that.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for responding to my questions. That was helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And I see that George has also been very active on the chat room, but you have your hand up now for a while, so please go ahead.
George Carrico speaking. Before I ask my questions, I'll ask Paul Keating's question, which he posted to the chat room. Can you ask if the current UDRP mutual jurisdiction would work if it was accompanied by a corresponding waiver by the respondent of a right to recover damages? This would not be an obligation. It would give the IGO the ability to terminate the UDRP.
Well, David Sotolo here. From my point of view, I, for reasons that you can probably guess, I'm really reluctant to address a hypothetical. I don't know, and it wouldn't be my call anyway. I'd have to, run down the hall and consult with some people. So, sorry, I can't answer it.
George Carrico's here. Well, I think the reason why Paul Keating asked that question is that, the PDP working group has kind of bent over backwards to consider alternatives, and one of the alternatives is to, basically maintain the UDRP, but circumscribe the scope of that immunity so that, we're trying to ascertain which aspects of immunity are you concerned about. Are you concerned about some court, giving a, $10 million damage award to somebody if you brought a UDRP and it was challenged in court? Or are you concerned about, production of documents, for discovery of documents in a lawsuit? Are you concerned about, perjury if, a witness in a court case was found to have perjured in support of, that dispute? Or are you just concerned about, money, basically, that, if the dispute is only about the domain name, then all that the, domain owner could get in terms of property would be the domain name. So that's the only item under dispute. I think that's the motivation for Paul Keating's question.
David Sotolo again. I think those are all fair questions, and they're also fact-specific that I just I wouldn't know where to begin to start addressing them.
Tom Pizarro from the OECD, just also to add that the issue is, when it comes to immunity, the issue is, again, it's a fundamental question of how IGOs operate, and allowing us to operate without interference from any one state. And the problem is, when you submit to the jurisdiction of a national court, it opens up the door for undue interference with our activities from a specific member state. So that's where, that's where the issues lie. And I'm not sure that it's really legally possible to circumscribe immunity and, stepping into a court and then saying, okay, we now decide that our immunities extend to, point A but not point B. These are really fact-specific questions, and I've never encountered a case like that when we're talking about trying to waive certain immunities but preserve others. I mean, it's just that I'm not sure that it's legally coherent or possible, and it's and I fail to see the relevance of the question, because again, we're talking about a fundamental issue of a principle here, and one that worries us in terms of interference from the state courts, and it's difficult to see how those issues could play out. And so attempting to circumscribe immunities in a certain way wouldn't necessarily be helpful and wouldn't necessarily protect us from the kinds of interference that we're concerned about.
George Karikos here. Let me just kind of respond to that before I ask my next question. I think the concern of registrants is that they have, you know, when you look at the IGOs saying giving a principled response instead of a pragmatic one, that it almost compels the registrants to give their own principled response that, you know, we have a right to the national courts. The EDRP supplements the law, isn't a replacement for the law. And so if there's not going to be any compromise, then you're not giving any reason for domain owners to compromise either. And so if there's going to be a middle ground, both sides would need to shift their positions and be a little bit more pragmatic. And that means specifying exactly which aspect of immunity is of most concern rather than just, you know, a theoretical approach. And so, you know, registrants, you know, have valuable property, like these twoletter.com domains, for example, can have a wholesale value, like a minimum floor value of $800,000. And many of them could be, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars for, you know, specific strings. So these are not, you know, somebody doing, you know, a typo of www.oecd.org or something like that, like a basically worthless domain name. Those are the kinds of disputes the EDRP, I think, was designed for, you know, clear-cut abuse. But the disputes that would be brought into court, you know, the cases that the EDRP was not designed for and which, you know, expressly allowed for court action, are the kinds of cases where a registrant is not going to waive their right to national court proceedings. And, you know, if the EDRP didn't exist in the first place, the IGOs would have had to go to court and waive their immunity by default. Like, if that's the only way they could dispute a domain name, they have no way to compel a domain owner or a property owner or an alleged infringer or malfeasor or whatever to stop doing what they're doing. And so, you know, if you expect, you know, one side to compromise when and only compromise and not move your position, then, you know, that just basically argues for the status quo to let the courts decide.
George, if I could, David Sotoli, if I could just jump in. With respect, I think your questions go way beyond why we were invited to attend this meeting today, which was to respond to questions about our memo that we submitted. We certainly can't and don't represent, even in the context of this meeting, the other IGOs. So, the kind of open-ended questions that you're asking may be valid, but they're beyond the scope of why we're here today, and it would be inappropriate for us to even purport to respond on behalf of the IGO community writ large or even our own institutions. That's not why we're here today.
John Passaro from the OECD. Let me also just add that in terms of talking about a middle ground, I think there has been a great middle ground that was proposed by Professor Swain himself, and that was the arbitration option. So it's very unfair to say that we haven't been willing to compromise at all. Arbitration presents a great way forward, and as Professor Swain noted in his memo, it's what we use with when we enter into commercial contracts with suppliers and things like that, in order to ensure that everyone does have recourse to some sort of dispute resolution mechanism without IGOs having to waive our immunities, which is also not just a principled point. It is also a pragmatic issue, again, for the reasons that we said in the memo, which are that it presents real opportunities for states to interfere with us and compromises our ability to carry out our activities.
Thanks. Peter, if I can just step in. I can understand this, that you cannot reply to all questions today, and also that we want to make some pretty soon some initial conclusions on the working group, so we don't we will not before that reach out formally, waiting for a long time input. But I think, was it you, David, that said that if we have additional questions, we could communicate, even if it's not official IGU community inputs. Because it would be good if there come up some specific topic that we would, before we end up with our initial suggestion and report, to have some quick input from at least IGU representatives, even if it's not official, to guide us. And also, if we do so, we need a fairly quick clear reply back, yes or no, so to speak. Is that possible to have that kind of communication?
Well, David Stoller here. I think the issue, one issue for us, comes back to how that to and fro would fit into the broader discussion that we're having with various parts of the ICANN community, the board, the GAC, the staff. I mean, it's not without its own resource implications on our side. Of course, in principle, we're happy to do so. I don't know. You know, we also have this small core group of IGOs that was constituted in part at the request of the GSNO back in at the ICANN meeting in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, which is, you know, really probably where those kind of questions should be addressed. John and I and Brian's institutions are part of that core group, but we also importantly have the UN and a couple of other organizations there. And that also involves the GAC, as well as other members of ICANN, the corporate entity. So, I'm cognizant of wanting to be responsive to help you guys get to a resolution, but I'm also cognizant that we've got a lot of irons in the fire and that we're kind of spinning our wheels a little bit in getting towards resolution. So I'm struggling a bit with where it's all going and, you know, how much more time it's going to take. And
yeah, that's also why I just put out this question. I know that from all groups of interest, in order to get a formal reply, everybody must be heard and writing down on the side on the reply. But from time to time, it's also good to have, even if it's not an official comment and a comment that we cannot officially refer to, if there is some way to get just an input, even if it's not, I mean, a quick reply, even if it's, sorry, this time we can't say yes or no, or we can't reply to this, it must be going further to the group, or hopefully it could be, well, this is our my opinion or the three of us that thinks this could be a good solution or apply to your question, if you understand me.
Yeah, understood.
Good. Well, I take it that we can at least try to do it that way. And now I give it to Mary. Sorry, your hands are up.
Not at all, Peter. This is Mary from staff, and I suppose at risk of jumping slightly ahead to the last point on the agenda, which I'll try not to, Peter, it seems to staff who have been trying to help coordinate and align the different groups and types of work that David and others have spoken about, that particularly in light of the most recent GAC communique, as well as the discussions in Helsinki between the GAC, the GNSO board members, and the IGOs, that there is a sense amongst most, if not all, that this needs to be resolved or at least carried forward towards resolution in a fairly short period of time. So to the extent that it helps Peter, David, and everyone, staff would be happy to try to facilitate communications amongst the different persons and parties to the extent that we can. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. That was excellent. And then I think we have to proceed with the two last topics here on agenda. But John and David, thank you so much for your input here today. I know that Brian at least has followed us as an observer. I'm not so sure about you two, but you're of course free to do so to see what we are working on, and also to give us input as we discussed now. Point four, I don't think we have so much time to discuss that further today, but just saying quickly that we are now obviously in the final phase. We will just start discussion next week. As you can see on the agenda, there are, initially we had three possible policy options to modify the UGRP URS based on alternatives identified to date or other suggestions, recommend no changes to either processes, or develop a new separate procedure. I'm not here to take the lead forward to any of those possible solutions as it's up to the full working group to decide, but I understand it from both our discussions in our working group as well as informal inputs from at least WIPO that there is so far no strong support for making a formal modifications of the present UDRP and or the URS. And as you know, there is a new working group dealing with the review all rights protection mechanism in all GTLDs, and Phil Corbin is one of the three co-chairs there. And it will start work on the URS at the beginning of next year, if I'm not wrong, and with the review of the UDRP at the beginning of 2018. So without processing any statements, I think it's not our case to make the suggested modifications of the UDRP. As you may know, we had, back in January 2015, we discussed some kind of informative instructions guidelines rather than a change where we suggested reference to Article 6 of the Paris Convention, but that was not suggested as an amended UDRP, but more of some kind of informative instructions guidelines rather than a change. So next steps, timeline to initial report. If I understood it correctly, we plan to have our initial report before ICANN in Hyderabad. Hopefully a decent time before that. And I think also, if Phil's still on the, yes, will this be up to the Genessa Council meeting next week on the agenda?
Excuse me, Peter, Phil here. What's the question about the council?
Well, the topic of our working group, will it be up on the council in some way, or?
I don't think so, really. Actually, I just saw the proposed agenda while this call was going on. It might only come up in passing about ongoing working groups. We're not one of the working groups that's being considered for a possible face-to-face meeting on the first day of the that's a facilitated face-to-face meeting. We would still have our regular, you know, 1 or 2 hour slot during the meeting. But since we're at the end stage, we're not one of the big new groups that's being considered for that. So, no, I might, I think there will be probably continuing discussion on the council meeting, perhaps, of the state of play on the blocking mechanisms, which are just temporary right now, and because there was continuing the discussion in Helsinki about there was some disquiet within council about the fact that the board's been engaging with the GEC and the small IGO group for 2 years, and the council, you know, which is supposed to make policy, has had no idea what's going on behind those closed doors, and no projected date yet for when the board's going to come down from the mountain and present their findings and opinions. So, yep. But I don't know of any specific thing on the agenda relating to our working group. I can do a quick report to them about, you know, that we anticipate having at least a preliminary report and recommendations out for public comment before the Hyderabad meeting.
Okay. Thanks, Phil. And there we are on the end of the agenda today. Mary? Sorry.
Thanks, Peter. No problem. I just wanted to follow up on Phil's comments. As he notes, there is not a specific agenda item for the GNSO Council's meeting next week on this topic, but the working group might like to know that one of the agenda items is actually the possibility of the GNSO Council providing a response or input to the board on the GAC's communique. And the GAC communique from Helsinki does include advice on the IGO topic, noting the work that's going on and the need to resolve it. So in that context, the points that Phil made about the concerns that were expressed by the council and discussed in Helsinki could come up, and it would probably be helpful for the council to know what the timeline of this group is. So to that extent, for the last agenda item, and Peter and Phil, you guys have already mentioned this, we would have quite a substantial period of time, you know, optimistically speaking. We're in mid-July now, and if we would like to publish our initial report prior to ICANN 57, the latest time we would want to do that is mid-October, so that still gives us up to 3 months. And the idea for that would be, once it's published at least 2 weeks of the Hyderabad meeting, we can use ICANN 57 to discuss any initial community feedback or to present the reasons and rationale for our recommendations to the broader community. The other thing about setting the date, of course, is going back to the conversation with David and John that we just had this past hour, which is trying to align all the different things going on and trying to get a final sense from the board as to the, I guess, the fate of the work of the small group. So those are just my thoughts, trying to sort of tie everything together and looking ahead for our group.
Thanks, Mary, for that update. And I think that we all agree to that timeline, and that we are actually in the phase now where we can make that preliminary report, at least, to get the initial comments. So thank you all for today, and I end the meeting. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.